Hi, my name's June. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Thank you, Mary. I want to thank the committee and all of you for inviting me and allowing me to be a part of your convention. I had one of those days today where I didn't need a meeting, I needed a convention. So it's nice to be at one. And I've already seen a few people here who mean a lot to me. And I wasn't able to get here very early, and I know there's a lot more. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, throughout the country, really, is filled with people who have touched my life, much the way that Mary shared that I was able to touch hers, just by taking some time. Some of them, I don't even remember their name, but I remember the stories that they shared. And I've always been, you know, kind of a story person. I'm not that good. You know, someone will say, do you know, Joe D? And I'll go, I don't know. And they'll go, you know, the guy who's Doberman drank vodka, and I'm like, oh yeah, I use a lot of the things he said, that helps me. So I'm just that kind of I know more about the story sometimes than the individual. I'm going to go ahead and start my my talk the way that I almost always do, because I think it's just real important and it works for me. I want to welcome any of you who might be new or who might be visiting Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to start by saying that I'm not an expert on alcoholism or Alcoholics Anonymous or anything else that I'm going to be standing up here talking about tonight. I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to stand up here and share, as the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous suggests that we do, a little bit about what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. I want you to know a couple of things, though, you know, as well as the fact that I'm not an expert or an authority. I want you to know that Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. A lot of people come to Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of different ways. Over the years since I've been sober, there have been a lot more ways for people to get into Alcoholics Anonymous, including a number of hospitals and treatment centers and a variety of other, you know, programs like that. I don't know anything about those particularly. I don't have any problem with however anybody gets to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I want to be very clear that I know that sometimes it gets a little bit murky when you come in through a place like that and you're paying money. I want to be very clear that Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. Had Alcoholics Anonymous not been free, I never could have come here. Had Alcoholics Anonymous not remained free, I never could have stayed. I was well over 10 years. I was well over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I could put a dollar in the basket on anything like a regular basis. So this is not about money. You know, and it's real important for me to remember that, and I want to be sure to share that in case anybody is here and not quite sure about that. I'm one of those people who believes I was born an alcoholic. I don't want to have a philosophical discussion with any of you about that after the meeting. It's just what I believe, and I believe it because there was something wrong with me from the very beginning, you know. And I know that, you know, as I share tonight, a number of you are not going to identify with a lot of things that I share about, and that's okay. That's one of the reasons that most of us will recommend that you go to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous before you're able to make a decision about, you know, whether you are or not alcoholic. It's better to be in here by mistake than out there by mistake, you know. And there are plenty of people who do not identify with my story or where I came from, but it's important that I share it. You know, I think it's kind of interesting. A number of years ago now, I talked at a meeting, and a guy came up to me afterwards to thank me for talking, mostly because his sponsor was standing behind him. And he said, I want to thank you for your talk. He said, I don't really believe it was your story, but I like the way that you told it. And I love that because I thought, you know, only an Alcoholics Anonymous would be so paranoid that we'd think that people would take the time, make up a story, come around for a long time until they got invited to get up and share it, you know. But the other part that really, you know, meant the most to me about that is that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked like my story. And I looked like my story for a hell of a long time after I got here. You know, so it's really quite a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous that someone might doubt that I really came from where I share that I came from. I believe I was born an alcoholic. My first obsession in life was not alcohol or any kind of a chemical. My first obsession was suicide. And from my earliest memories, which go back to about 5 years old, I began to try and kill myself on a regular basis. And at that time, I began to take overdoses of baby aspirin. It was all I knew about at the time. I began to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades, and I began to beat and mutilate my body in many, many ways, and I was to continue to do that until after I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 7 years old, I was introduced to drugs. And when I was 8 years old, was the first time that I ever used alcohol, and it worked for me. And it worked for me in a way that I can remember as clearly tonight as I ever have. And I suppose the way that many of us, experience that first drink. It wasn't really that alcohol made me feel good, which again I know a lot of you won't identify with. It was simply that it made me not feel anything at all. And thank God it worked that way for me. I was never a party girl. I've never had a social drink in my life. I don't have any cute, funny stories to tell you about the things that I did when I was out there drinking. After I'd been drinking for about a year, I was introduced to barbiturates or reds or yellows or downers or whatever you might know them as. And that combination with alcohol was the only one that I ever needed. I never altered it. I never looked for anything else. It was my answer, and it worked perfectly. Again, because I wasn't out there trying to feel good. I wasn't out there trying to have a good time. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to be anything. I wanted to die. And up to and including today, as I look back on my life, I can certainly see that some of my suicide attempts were to get attention. But really and truly, before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and again for a while after I got here, but before I came here, I really, really wanted to die. I wanted out. Obviously, as you look at me tonight, you can see I wasn't very successful at suicide, but I did try a lot, and I'm very grateful that I was introduced to the alcohol and chemicals that I was introduced to, because I believe I would have had to been locked up in some kind of an institution had I not found them, because I couldn't make it out there. Life was just far too painful for me. I grew up in an alcoholic home. There was a lot of violence and a lot of abuse and a lot of the same kind of things that go on in any other alcoholic home, and I knew all about it firsthand. I didn't see it as alcoholism. I didn't see it as a disease, what was going on in my life, certainly. I did think my mother was weak because she wasn't controlling, what was going on. And in my life, there's never been anything that I have been less tolerant of in anyone, most of all myself, than those things that I was to give the weak label to. I was a little kid, and they'd say, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "A boy." It wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. But it was truly what I wanted to be. As a little kid, when I looked at these two different groups of people that were around a lot, most of whom I know today were alcoholic, before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not ever remember seeing a man cry under any circumstances. Now, that doesn't mean that men didn't cry. I'm only telling you the way that I remember the world and the world around me. And I don't remember ever seeing a man cry. I've seen men shot. I've seen them stabbed. I've seen them arrested. I've seen their wives leave them. I've seen their kids overdose. I've seen a lot of things happen. And I never saw a man shed a tear under any of those circumstances. I saw the women in my life go through each and every one of those circumstances. Some of them didn't cry, but most of them did. At some point, there was a breaking point. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I wanted to be like a guy. To me, that meant that you don't feel anything. The only emotion that you ever feel is rage or anger. That's all I ever thought guys felt, and that's how I wanted to live my life, And so as a little kid, they'd say, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "A boy." And my family was and is very active in the Catholic faith. And they began to take me to priests to counsel me and discuss this problem that I had. And because we were on welfare, I think the priest maybe knew this, or somebody found this out, that I was able to begin to see psychologists and psychiatrists about my suicide attempts or about the fact that I wanted to be a boy or whatever. But I don't have any kind of diagnosis to give you about what those people thought was wrong with me or what my problems were, because I felt about psychiatrists and psychologists much the way that my friend Patty Hicks always did. I thought they should have to work for their money. And I never told them anything. I never answered one question. I never filled out one form. I never played with one doll. I sat there the required 50 minutes, and then I walked out and I left. Somewhere along the line, as I was growing up, I had my first lesson in acceptance when I realized I wasn't going to be able to be a boy. And so the next best thing, the way that I saw the world, the only alternative for someone like me, was to be a tough broad. And I spent all my time before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. I grew up in Venice, and I've learned over the years in traveling around to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and meeting a lot of tough broads that actually there are some tough broad geographic standards. And if you're going to be a tough broad in Venice, it's very important that you don't wear shoes. Tough broads have tough feet. That's important. It's very important that you be in a gang, and I was. It's very important that you do a lot of fighting, and I did. It's very important that I remember to let you know tonight that I've never won a fight in my life. But I've also never fought less than five people at a time. And what my sponsor explained to me after I'd been sober for a while is, you know, if you fight one person and you lose, someone might think you're not a very good fighter. But if you always fight groups of five or more, then people think she must be pretty tough, or why would that many people have to jump her, you know? And so I was able to actually convince some people that I was tough, just by the way that I kind of situated my my fights. I most of the time I had a black eye or a swollen lip as I wandered around Venice, you know. I would stand down there on the boardwalk with my gang looking tough. And I'd see a touristy-looking people look at us, and I'd take my cigarette butt, and I'd throw it down on the sidewalk, and I'd put it out with my bare feet. And I'd see them, and they'd whisper back and forth to each other, and I knew what they were saying. They were saying, wow. That is one tough broad. And I was very impressed that I was able to do this, and I knew they were too. Again, after I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor explained to me that, do you know, perhaps some of those people were saying to each other, did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid? But I didn't know there was another way of looking at it, you know. So anyway, those were the kind of things that kept me busy before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I overdosed, I threw up a lot, passed out a lot, and I put my cigarette butts out, you know, in between my fights. And that's really pretty much what my life entailed before I came here. My mom had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many years with varying lengths of sobriety. And my mom came back to Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. And when she did, she brought me to a meeting, not because I asked for help, not because I wanted help, not because I admitted having a problem, because even if I had had a problem, I was not going to join an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. So I went to the meeting, and mainly she took me because she was afraid I might get her evicted from another apartment. And so I sat in the meeting, and that night the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous began for me, even though I didn't get sober that night. And it began for me, again, for some reasons that you may not identify with, but it began for me because there was a guy in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the whole world. And I did not admire very many people. This was one of the few in the whole world that I admired. And I admired Paul. He was actually a drinking friend of my mother's. And I admired him because there were so many reasons. He was one of the most hostile and violent people I'd ever known. He'd been in jails and prisons. He had tattoos. He had a motorcycle. Had a knife. Had it with him at the meeting that night. He was the kind of a guy, you know, if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, all I really wanted was I wanted the ability to walk into a room and back everyone away in terror. That's all I wanted. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. But that's really what I wanted out of life. And this guy, Paul, who, again, was a drinking friend of my mother, I had seen him walk into bars and I had seen him walk into parties. And if he wanted to sit at your table and he'd been drinking, you didn't even talk about it with him. You just gave him the table because you didn't know what he was going to do to get the table. And so I looked at this guy who had achieved everything that I wanted out of life, the ability to clear rooms and tables. And he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was very impressed. I mean, I just thought it was for weak people like my mom. I didn't know that anybody tough and strong would come to AA. So it made a big impression on me. I got drunk the next night, and then I came back to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't raise my hand because, as I've already told you, I wasn't going to join an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. But I went to, you know, a number of meetings in that two-week period of time. I didn't talk to anybody because the only person I would talk to here was Paul, this guy. He was the only person that I thought was cool enough here for me to talk to. And I explained to Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was far too young to be an alcoholic, that I wasn't anything like my mother, who was tremendously alcoholic, that I had places to go, people to see, things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me, and I was very clearly not alcoholic. Now, I later learned that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholic. You know, they already know that. And but Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm pretty new in this AA thing, and they've told me I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you use chemicals, and I happen to believe that if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't trying to make up something like a teacher in high school might do just to scare the kids. He was just talking about facts. He was talking about things that had happened and were beginning to happen in my life, and I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet in that two-week period of time, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. By the time I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person that I hated more than my mother was myself. And I hated my mother because she was an alcoholic, and I blamed her for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life. And take it from me, the short version, a lot had gone wrong. And by the time I got to this program, having not even joined, just the kind of a person that I was just filled with anger and rage. And I used to attack my mother, and my mother used to attack me as well, and we would fight, you know, and that was just sort of the way that it was. But when my mother was sober at this time, she didn't think she had to be attacked anymore. And she asked me to leave her home, and I did. The rest of my family had not spoken to me in a couple of years. I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances. I didn't even bother trying. I had been in a number of foster homes. I'd been thrown out of all of them. None of them would take me back. I tried to get into a few drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes. There weren't very many at that time, but I tried to get into those that I knew about. None of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. There was a program back then called Synanon that was absolutely desperate for membership. It was almost closing down, and they wouldn't take me either. And then I thought, you know what, who cares? Who cares about these programs and these families and all of that? Because none of that really matters. If you're a tough broad, there's only one thing that counts. There's only one thing that's important, and that's your gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I had no shoes. Wouldn't have worn shoes if I'd had them. I had no family. I had no money. I had no place to stay. I had the clothes that I had on, and I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you can see where it was really kind of simple. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? I mean, it was really a very easy call at that time. And I raised my hand. I know today that some of the people in that meeting did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, in particular the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I'm sure that those people did not know about that tradition is because when I began to raise my hand in that meeting and in a few of the meetings at that time, some of those people knew how old I was because of my mother, because she had been in and out of AA for so many years. And they came over to me and they told me I was too young to be an alcoholic. And they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meeting while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back, they'd get together and ask me to leave. And I didn't know that Alcoholics Anonymous couldn't do that. I certainly didn't know that there were traditions or that there was a third tradition. I just figured AA didn't want me either. And that was okay with me, because I didn't want me either. And I hadn't for as long as I could remember. And I fell back on my number one answer, the answer I'd been using since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's. I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at anyone's home I ever visited. I found enough of the kind of pills I needed to kill myself, and I took enough of them to do it one more time. And before I passed out that day, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't know about where you guys are going to meetings out here in the South Bay, but in West Los Angeles, where I went to that meeting, they almost never called on people to share who were laying in the meeting. But they called on me that day. And I certainly don't know what I said, but I know that the next thing I know, they realized I needed to be in a hospital, and that was where I woke up. And a doctor was giving me medication to make me throw up and explaining to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I really can't tell you why that overdose was any different than all the others that I'd inflicted upon myself. I just know that it was. I know that because since that day, one day at a time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. I've done that one day at a time since the 13th of July of 1972, and if I continue to do that, I'll celebrate 28 years of continuous sobriety this year. Now, it's really important to me that you know, particularly if you are new, that I never planned on staying here and staying sober for almost 28 years. If they'd given me the option when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on whether or not I wanted to go on living or not that long, I would have checked the no box. You know, so it's really been quite a remarkable, you know, adventure for me. I live a life today that I never would have wanted, and I'm a person that I wouldn't have even liked when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet most of the time I'm pretty happy. And that doesn't mean I don't have problems, you know, because I do. And, you know, it's funny, there's, you know, a friend of mine that I know a lot of you have heard share, Earl, you know, and he talks about the fact that, you know, we have all these areas. And, you know, all the problems that I have today are all in areas in which I didn't even have areas when I got to AA. So, you know, I mean, that always, I always am able to take a little bit of a lighter approach on it. I am so grateful to the people who were here in Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here. I mean, I suspect all of us have to feel that way at some level after we've been here a while, and maybe more so the longer that we're sober. But I'm very grateful to the people who tolerated me. Because I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, this may not surprise you, but I had a bad attitude. I didn't like men. The only men I'd ever known were violent, and they were alcoholics. And I figured if you guys were in here, you were probably like them too. And I didn't want anything to do with the men in Alcoholics Anonymous. As far as the women were concerned, I didn't like me, I didn't like my mother, and I didn't like any of the other women in Alcoholics Anonymous either. Which, of course, was a problem because in July of 1972, when I came here, all they had were men and women, and I didn't like any of them. I didn't sit next to women. I didn't hug women. I didn't shake hands with women. And I did not like listening to women speakers, which is something that always makes me feel better because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like. I didn't wear shoes most of the first 2 years that I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. After I'd been sober, I got here smoking. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. I lit all of them myself. Occasionally, someone would hold a match for me, and I let them hold it as long as they liked. But they never lit my cigarette with them. After I'd been sober a short period of time, I took up smoking cigars and then later a pipe. I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and my ankles. I had a jacket that on the back said, "Do unto others and then split." It was my own little spiritual logo, but it never really caught on at any of the clubhouses. I had a very limited vocabulary. It consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions, the and mother. And there were a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who were extremely offended by the use of that type of language, so I tried to use it more whenever they got near me. And what I want to let you know is if you choose to dress that way, talk that way, and act that way, you too can sit in a meeting almost this big and have an entire row all to yourself. My home group today is the Thursday Night Brentwood Workshop, and it's a fabulous meeting. I've been going to that meeting since I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the meeting that I hated the most in the early years of my sobriety. And it's, you know, it's been such a funny evolution, you know, for me. I've been attending, like I said, regularly for almost 28 years. I think when I was about 18 or 19 years sober, the steering committee offered me my first commitment at that meeting. I was wearing shoes most of the time by then. And, you know, it's funny because one of my first sponsors came up to the podium when I was, like, signing court cards after the meeting. And he came up and he said, "I heard a rumor out in the valley that they had made you secretary here, and I had to come and see if it was true." You know, so it's been very slow here for me. I haven't really been a rocket to stardom in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had this bad attitude, and I was able to use it pretty effectively to keep a lot of people away. And I'm very grateful to the people who tolerated me, like I said, you know, because I think they were far more tolerant than I might be up to and including today. I got a sponsor, and it was a woman, which is something that never fails to amaze me. Still, because I've already given you some indication and of what I thought about women. And this particular woman, you know, she became my sponsor because I went to 21 meetings a week, and I did that for most of the first couple of years of my sobriety. I had no place else to go. I was always on my way to a meeting, on my way from a meeting, helping set up the meeting. I had a commitment at every one of those meetings, not because I was a great AA, not because I wanted a gold star in AA, because I had no place else to go and nothing else to do. And so I just got very involved. And I think it also had a lot to do with the fact that I couldn't put a dollar in the basket. So I went to my home group, the Brentwood group, and I set up 420 chairs, slamming them down one at a time. But I figured that ought to be worth about $1. You know, and nobody better say anything to me about not putting in at the seventh tradition, you know. So anyway, that's sort of, you know, the way I did things. It wasn't like with a great attitude, of course, but I did it. And my sponsor's home group at that time was the Brentwood meeting. And she became my sponsor, and I confirmed this later, because she was taught to never say no to an AA request. And I would see Gail Wilson, you know, at the Thursday night Brentwood meeting. You know, The reason I asked Gail to be my sponsor is because it seemed like she spoke at about 18 of the 21 meetings I went to every week. You know, I couldn't get away from this woman, and I thought maybe if I asked her to be my sponsor, I could find out ahead of time where she was speaking, and I wouldn't have to go hear her. So that was my motivation there. And I'd see Gail at Brentwood, and she'd say, "Now, June, look, don't sit next to me at the meeting tonight." She said, "I can't take the cigar smoke." And I'd say, "Okay." And then I'd turn to walk away, and she'd say, "And please, don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor." And that was fine with me, because I didn't want anyone to know I was hanging out with someone lame like her. I mean, Gail not only did not use the words I used, she didn't know what a lot of the words I was using meant. You know. And as if that wasn't bad enough, I mean, there were all kinds of problems with Gail. Gail had come from a warm, loving family. I hated people like that, automatically. You know, she'd gone to college, she'd traveled around the world, and as if all of that was not bad enough, she actually was seen on a number of occasions in public wearing pink. Something that I did not do until I was over 10 years sober did I have anything pink even in the car with me. You know what I mean? It's like, if you're wearing pink, get another ride. I mean, we're just not doing that. So, it was just really a fascinating thing, and I can never think of Gail without thinking about what it says in the book, where it says that we are people who normally would not mix, you know, and I am so grateful that Gail was a part of my life, you know, and there were so many people like that. I was thinking that, you know, of course, I was thinking of Marion Chapman, you know, and the International Convention is coming up, you know, as I'm sure a lot of you know, and the first time I was able to get to the International, I haven't been able to get to all of them, but I got to go to that one, and Marion Chapman let me sleep on her floor, you know, and she told me if I could get there, I could sleep on her floor of her hotel room, and you know, I'll never forget that. You know, I didn't hardly know her. You know, I just heard her speak and kind of followed her around, but she was always very kind to me, and she'd talk about, you know, wearing your sobriety, and you know, there are so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous that have touched my life, even when I didn't even know they were touching it, you know, even when I didn't want to let them. I got very active. My home group when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was the Monday Night Venice Group. I know there's a number of you here who have been to it. It's the best meeting in the world in 1972, and I don't know if I could have stayed sober without that meeting. It was incredible, and I fit right in. I didn't even hardly stand out there. It was just great, you know. And, you know, the first time I talked at a meeting was at that group, my home group, and when I finished talking, the secretary came over to me and told me if he'd wanted to hear my mother's story, he would have asked her to talk. So it was really a slow process of getting to the point where I could sort of see my own story and where I came from and where I had taken a few wrong turns or bad actions. I got the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, at the Monday Night Venice Group, they'd say it's very important that you get the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because that is where the program is, and that's where you're going to learn about it. Now, if you don't have enough money, they'd say at the Venice Group, you're going to make credit arrangements, whatever kind you want, including nothing down or nothing a week. You take that book home. And if you're too afraid to talk to somebody about it or you don't want to talk to somebody about it, you just go ahead and steal it. Well, I've been stealing longer than I've been drinking, and I saw no reason to give up stealing because I was sober. They were unrelated activities as far as I was concerned. And I didn't give up stealing, you know, right away. But I had this feeling that if I stole a big book from an AA meeting, it could possibly jinx my sobriety. And so instead I went to the library in Santa Monica and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous there. And while I was there, I stole a copy of the 12 and 12. I'd heard a lot of people talk about that book. I thought it must be kind of important, too. And I can remember, you know, I had another sponsor, the same guy who drove out from the valley back then. And I can remember I called Jeff up that day and go, "Hey, Jeff, I got the book today. I stole it at the library." And, you know, he didn't say, "You know, June, we don't steal. We're rigorously honest. You know, we try and change." He goes, "That's great. You got the book." You know, because he knew it was like, wow, she's getting into the program. You know, I mean, you got to start somewhere. After I'd been sober for a while, I realized that, you know, I needed to make amends for having stolen this library book, along with the countless other library books I'd stolen during my life, including great classics like Misty the Seahorse and things like that. It's not easy as a tough Venice broad to walk into the library with books like that and offer to pay them back, you know, one day at a time. Because, you know, they wanted 3 to 5 cents a day, and I'd had some of the books for like 11 years, you know, and I had to make payments. And she said, "You know, that's really funny." She said, "I used to work at this library in Laguna Beach, and this man came in. He'd stolen the big book just like you." She said, "I guess you guys do this all the time." So it's just another, you know, lesson of how I'm not really unique. Let's see, what will I talk about? I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a seventh grade education. I dropped out of school. I never really went back. You can see where I might not just fit into your local junior high right away there. And, you know, I just got commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my commitment at the Tuesday night Westwood meeting, I was the greeter. I would stand there barefoot with my motorcycle chains and jacket, cigar, welcoming the newcomers as they came to AA. Sometimes as they'd walk by, I'd hear their sponsor whisper, "You see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that." When I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, people were guessing my age at 37. I was 13 at the time. And I looked a hell of a lot closer to 37. You know, it's funny because I'm 41 tonight as I stand up here. And I feel, you know, at least 2,000 years younger than I did when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it's going to hit me. I'm going to wake up in a midlife crisis any day now. But I was so old when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not believe that anything, any power, any of these little things that you guys talked about could do anything to take that feeling away. When I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I hated everything about myself. And I always had, for as far back as I can remember. I didn't like being tall. I didn't like being skinny. I didn't like having curly red hair. I didn't like coming from the family I came from. I didn't like being from Venice. And most of all, I never, for one instant, ever liked the way that I was feeling. And so for someone like me, I have to be extremely grateful that I found alcohol so that I could tone it down sometimes and get a little break for myself, you know? And getting sober and walking in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous did not magically take all that away. It sounded like it happened for a lot of you guys. It sounded like, you know, a lot of you got taken to a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, or it sounded like a lot of you had lost your self-worth at some point, and then it seems to me as if people got a 90-day chip or maybe a one-year cake if they had a really bad story, and then they were like their own best friend and they could look other people in the eye and, you know, their family was just gleefully happy that they were sober and there and, you know, things like that. And that's how it sounded to me. I was over 5 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I got a Christmas card from my family. And, you know, that's not telling you as much about them as it is about me and what I had done and how I acted and how I treated people. You know, I mean, I was like over 15 years sober before I got a key to anything. You know what I mean? There were like reasons for this. You know, they were really watching me for a long time. But, you know, getting sober didn't change the way that I felt about myself at all. I still hated everything about myself. And I didn't take baths or showers after I got sober. Part of it had to do with the fact that I didn't know how often people did that sort of thing. You know, I never stood around with my gang saying, "Do you use Crest or Colgate?" You know, they just weren't things that I talked about, and I felt really stupid not knowing those things. But most of it had to do with the fact that I knew a bath or a shower was not going to make me feel any better about who I was. And I didn't believe Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be able to do very much about it either. Because the longer I stayed sober, the more I remembered about the things that I did. And suddenly, those things that seemed kind of cool and that I was kind of proud of when I was on the streets, I didn't feel proud of anymore. And I didn't feel like bragging about them anymore. I didn't feel like talking about them anymore, you know. And I didn't really know, you know, what Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be able to do about that. And yet, as I listened to the people here share about their pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization and the point where they were taken by alcoholism, and the place where the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous led them afterwards, I truly believed that it happened for those people. And I did feel a tiny bit of hope here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the hope, I think that the best way I could describe it is that I certainly didn't hope that I could look in a mirror and be my own best friend and smile at myself. But I did believe that maybe one day as I walked down a street, if I happened to glance in one of those storefront windows where you can't really help but get a reflection of yourself, I thought maybe I won't feel like throwing up at what I see looking back. And that was enough hope to keep me coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I can remember I was 7 years sober, and I was at the Palm Springs Roundup. And Gail Wilson was, you know, working on the hostesses, and I was one of the hostesses that she had chosen. That was my assignment, you know, that weekend to be there. And on that Saturday night, we were at the banquet, and someone had given me a dress to wear, and I was wearing it, and I was looking around the room at the banquet, comparing myself to other people, something I still do today if I'd like to feel miserable. But I still do it sometimes, you know. But anyway, I was comparing myself and looking around, and I said, "Wow. Look at that black dress over there. Don't you wish you were wearing that black dress? Is that gorgeous or what?" And then, "No, I talked to myself too. But what do you mean no? I said, no, I'm kind of glad I'm wearing this brown dress. This is a nice dress. This is fine. I'm glad I'm wearing this. I thought, all right, wait a minute. Green is your favorite color. All right, do you see that gorgeous green dress over there? Are you telling me you wouldn't rather be wearing the green dress over there? I thought, no, no, I'm glad I'm wearing this brown dress. And I started asking myself other questions. You know, I didn't even want to be blonde or stacked or anything. I wanted to be tall and I wanted to be skinny. I wanted to have curly red hair. I wanted to be from Venice. I didn't wish I had your mother. I didn't wish I'd come from your town. I didn't wish I was going out with your boyfriend. I didn't wish I was driving your car. I wanted to just be who I was right then. I didn't even wish I was sitting at the fun banquet table. You know what I mean? I was like, I was glad I was at that banquet table. And then I asked myself something that may not seem as amazing to you as it was to me. But I realized that not only all of that, which I never in a million years believed that Alcoholics Anonymous could have done. And let me tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, we had some very persuasive people here, you know, in 1972. And I never would have believed that I could get to a point where I wouldn't want to trade places with anyone else as I sat at that table. But more importantly than all of that, for me, at that moment, I wanted to feel like I was feeling. And I had never had that experience in my entire life. Not before drinking, not during, and not after. And I can't really tell you how Alcoholics Anonymous accomplished that. And I think that, you know, I mean, in one sense, the fact that I tell you I was about 7 years sober, I mean, that would not be a good message of hope, I suppose, if you're having a hard time at 30 days, you know what I mean? But it's the way that it was for me. You know, it was a slow process. And I can certainly see that there were things I could have done to speed it up, I suppose, but I didn't do them. So that's where I was. But, you know, just the fact that this could happen for someone like me is just so remarkable, you know. And there are certainly some days today, you know, where I'd like to trade places with other people in certain areas. Every once in a while that thought still, you know, crosses my mind. And yet most of the time, by and large, I really don't want to trade places. You know, not totally. I mean, I might see a certain little thing and I think, oh, gee, that would be nice. You know what I mean? But bottom line, overall, I wouldn't want to trade places with anyone. I can't believe that that's possible for someone like me who always wanted to trade places with someone else, you know. I believe that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, through the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of it through the actions that I was taught to take by being a member of my home group, by being active in service. I'm so grateful that I was taught about the traditions and the service aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I believe that it saved my life far beyond anything else. Because, you know, the evolution of what's happened for me here has been like I've had plastic surgery. I just haven't had it. Because when I look in the mirror, I don't see what I used to see. And I don't feel the way I used to feel. And I don't act the way I used to act. You know, and it's absolutely unbelievable to me. After I'd been sober for a while, I got an opportunity, and Gail actually made a lot of arrangements to help me go to a business college, learn how to be a secretary. If there's anything I never wanted to be in my life, it was a secretary, but she arranged that, and I felt like I had to show up one day at a time. And I tried. I started out typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors. I typed one day at a time for 14 months. And at the end of that time, I was typing 37 words a minute with 19 errors. I just am not really a typist. And I had already known that, you know. But anyway, I was able to go out and get another kind of a job because of that experience. Gail, you know, kind of pushed me along, and I went out there. And it was very, very difficult. I was like 2 years sober at that time. And I had to go out and look for jobs in what I called the citizen-y type world. You know, I didn't know a lot of people in the citizen-y type world. And I didn't know how to dress like those people. I didn't know how to talk with those people. I was just beginning to wear shoes. But, you know, people like Patty Hicks and Gail, they gave me some clothes. And, you know, they told me, like, kind of what you wear and, you know, and those kind of things. And I put these clothes on. It really was very much like, you know, I felt like, hey, look at the little Venice Bride in the Halloween costume that looked dressed up like a citizen. But I went ahead and I showed up anyway, and I filled out my little applications. And, you know, I seemed like I went on millions of interviews, and one day I finally got a job, and I was very happy. I knew Gail would be thrilled. It was so square. I was working in an insurance company, the kind of thing your sponsors love. And I went to work, and I worked really, really hard, and on the seventh day they called me in. I thought maybe they wanted to give me a raise. And they said, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to let you go. And they said, you don't have enough experience for this job. And not only that, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. Now, I didn't know what common sense was, but I knew I was being insulted. And I had been going to meetings, 21 meetings a week, for over 2 years at that point. And I had never, ever heard of anyone sober in AA being fired. And I didn't think we were going to allow things like this to happen. And I went downstairs and I called central office and I reported this company. I mean, I thought we were going to pick it or something, you know. And they just laughed and told me to, you know, go out and interview again. Well, you know, this didn't really help my confidence in my costume. But anyway, I went out and this lady on the program called me up in Culver City. And she said, I'm going to take you, there's an interview downtown at a bank. I'd never been in a bank in my whole life. And she took me downtown to a bank. I'm starting to fill out this application in this bank. It's a huge application. You know, they're going to bond you, you know, for goodness sakes. You know, I'm filling out this application and it says, due to the fact that as a bank employee, it's necessary that you be bonded, we're going to do a thorough background check. And I thought, oh, no, not me. I mean, they call one library and I have had it. You know, I just don't want anybody looking into my past, you know. But I thought about this thing about, you know, the AA thing, you know, do the footwork and leave the results up to God. And so I went ahead and I filled out this application and I turned it in. And they called me back on a series of interviews. And they not only hired me to work in the bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if AA worked that good, you know. But it did. I worked there and I never stole anything. I'm not going to tell you I didn't think about stealing anything, but I didn't steal anything, you know, and that was just so remarkable. And while I was there, I started taking a class at night that I had heard about. It was called a dummy English class. That's what people called it. And I went to take this class because even though I was capable of reading words, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail, I couldn't hold a whole sentence of words that had any meaning in my mind. I mean, I couldn't do it, and I couldn't carry conversations on with people. Hard for anybody who knows me today to believe. You know, and I made old-timers nervous because we'd be talking, and suddenly I'd go, bird, you know. I heard, you know, music the first 9 months that I was sober. I never told anybody. One day I saw this woman, she took a one-year cake, and she said, you know, the music stopped today. And I thought, oh, God, I should have talked about this. We'd probably been listening to the same station, you know, but I... Anyway, there were a lot of problems, you know, that I was having. But anyway, I went ahead and I took this dummy English class so that I could learn how to read again. And then I took a couple more classes. And then I ended up getting laid off at the bank and I got a job on campus at the college, the city college. And I started to take more and more classes and I got two jobs so that I could work my way through college. And I kept showing up and trying to do the best I could and keeping my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the end of, I guess it was really 3 years, they called me in and told me I'd completed the requirements for what they called an AA college degree. I thought that was a nice name for a college degree. I never wanted a college degree. I never really thought I could, you know, get one, but I was amazed, you know. And I graduated third in my class out of almost 500 students. You know, and I used to stand at the Westwood meeting door as the greeter, and after two or three people came in and introduced themselves, I was having trouble remembering which of the names was mine because I'd heard too many, you know. And I knew without a shadow of a doubt then, as I do now, that June could not have done that, that Alcoholics Anonymous made that possible for me. You know, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of other people who can do that, but not me. People who come from where I came from don't act like that and don't do that. It's not possible. Anyway, I went ahead and I continued with school after that. I'd come up with this dream that I had, and Gail told me I had to do the same footwork that I had to do before or after, you know, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, the same footwork anybody in or out of the program had to do. And I went ahead and I did that footwork. And my other sponsor, Bobby, you know, kind of shared some ideas and some things I needed to do. And I went ahead and I sent out these applications. And it's been a while now. I think, gosh, almost 20 years that I got a letter telling me that I'd been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. Now, I'll tell you, I always planned on spending a lot of time in court, but never on that side of the table, you know. And I was able to show up at law school, and it was very, very difficult in a lot of ways. But I learned some wonderful things there, and not so much maybe about the law or those kind of things, although I learned those things as well. But there, for me, that was where I learned a lot of spiritual lessons that have worked very well for me. That was where I started to learn that I'm just one of God's kids, and so are the people in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that became comfortable for me. And I began to just see that we come from different places, you know, either in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we arrive on different paths. And I met some people in law school that were very, very spiritual people. You know, they didn't go to meetings, and they didn't have to, you know, do the things that I have to do. They didn't have to call their sponsor when they got, you know, mad at someone or whatever. But they had these spiritual tools, and it was really interesting to me to learn that there were people out there that were practicing some of the same things that I need to learn here, you know, because this is what works for me. I went ahead and I did finish law school, and after that I was able to get a job, which was a job that I love very, very much. It's a job that I still have today. And it's a job where I believe I'm able to be of service. And I'm very grateful that I was able to get that job. I'm very grateful that my sponsor, Gail, encouraged me to get involved in that job, even though there were a lot of other options or different ideas. And Gail knew that that was what was right for me. My sponsor, Gail, died in 1983, right before I graduated from law school. And I knew that Gail was sick. She was 48 years old. But I didn't know that she was that sick because she kind of hadn't told me a lot of the stuff. In the last couple of months that she was dying, I went and spent a lot of time with her at the hospital. And, you know, she was in the hospital most of the time. She had a constant staff of people coming in and out. And Gail never missed a chance to introduce me to one of these strangers who, I assure you, had no interest whatsoever in meeting me. They just wanted to do their job, I'm sure. But, you know, she would stop them and she'd go, nurse, I want you to meet Junie. Junie's like a daughter to me. And she's going to be an attorney. And I thought, you know, this is the same woman who used to say, don't sit next to me at the meeting and don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. You know, now she's stopping strangers in the hospital, you know, to introduce me. And that was where I did confirm the, she was taught to never say no to an AA request kind of thing. You know, we talked about that. And she said, you know, June, when you asked me to be your sponsor, she said, I accepted because I'd been taught to never say no. She said, I did not think you were going to make it. She said, there was no reason to think that you were going to make it. She said, with your attitude and your background, I was sure that you were hopeless. She said, but I'd been taught to not say no. And she said, you know, and then I watched you and I watched, you know, some of your insanity. And, you know, and she and a couple of other people who, you know, have worked with me and sponsored me, I mean, they've said that I actually looked worse after 4 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous than I did, you know, in the early months. You know, because my life didn't change for a long time here. I just didn't believe or wasn't willing to accept that there could be another way to live, you know. Anyway, and she said, you know, I can remember when you called me up and you said, I'm going to take a class at school. She said, I didn't say anything, but I knew you'd never finish. You hadn't finished anything ever, you know. I mean, I couldn't even keep a job for like a whole week, you know, in AA. Because I'd like, you know, call up or just do something, you know. I mean, I just wouldn't go or... I'd go to bed at night at like 2 in the morning after coffee, and I'd say, all right, God, they want me to be at that job at 8 in the morning. So if it's your will, make sure I'm awake. Yeah. And God didn't want me to work there or any place else, really, it seemed. And so, you know, I had problems with applying the principles, you know. Anyway, and she said, you know, when you told me you were going to take that class, she said, I knew you'd never finish, but I didn't say anything. And she said, and then I can remember you took a couple classes and you called me up one day and you said, Gail, I think I want to be a lawyer. She said, I had to force myself not to laugh out loud. She said, I knew you couldn't do that. She said, but I didn't say anything. And we talked about why she didn't say anything. And, you know, the reason was because, you know, Gail never believed in June, ever. But Gail always believed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she'd been sober long enough to see unbelievable things happen to people that they can't happen to. And that's why she didn't say it couldn't happen, I couldn't do it, it wasn't going to happen, you know, because she didn't know. And I certainly don't know what's going to happen in your life, nor do I know what's going to happen in mine, you know, in the future. I mean, it talks about in the book, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. I have to tell you, I'm completely amazed already. I don't know if I'm halfway through or not, you know, I might be past that, but I mean, I'm amazed. Because it wasn't, none of the things that mean a lot to me today were even on my list. Because I'm the kind of person that came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any dreams, I didn't have any hopes. I didn't want to go on any trips. I didn't want to, you know, do anything. I just really wanted to die. And I didn't stay in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid of going out in the streets and dying. I tried to die as long and as hard as I could out there. I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous because I believed that maybe I could be one of those people who could go back out there and live for another 20 or 30 years the way that I was living. And that's what I couldn't stand. Because by the time I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was not possible for me to go on breathing in and out anymore, hating myself as much as I did. It was just not possible. I couldn't go any lower and keep going on, you know. I guess I'm going to talk about one other area real quick, and then I'll sit down. Maybe I'll talk about that instead. Yeah, whatever. I guess I will. You know, sometimes it sounds like when I heard I'm stealing this because anything really good I always steal. And then Norm Alpe said you should give him credit like 2 times, and then it's kind of yours. But. I'll give Sandy B. credit tonight for a little bit of it anyway. And I heard Sandy, you know, talk on a tape, and he was saying about how sometimes, you know, you hear people like talk in a meeting. And, you know, I mean, if you think about it, if I'm going to stand up here for 45 minutes and share, and then I'm going to try and tell you about what it used to be like and then 28 years of sobriety, you know, I'm probably going to have to hit a few high points here. Or, you know, we're all going to, like, get a resentment. So what Sandy said is that, you know, sometimes it sounds sort of like, oh, things were really, really bad, and then I got sober, and it was really, really hard, you know. And then things were just kind of like, great, you know. And that it doesn't really give you the whole story, you know. Like Sandy was sharing about the fact that at one point he got thrown out of the Air Force. I'm pretty sure it was the Air Force. Sometimes people come up and correct me about what branch of the service. I apologize. But whatever it was, he got thrown out. And he was like passed over for promotion the third time, which is like something fatal when you're in there. And he was sober when that happened. And here he was, he'd gotten, you know, passed over when he was drinking, but he didn't expect this to happen sober. And now he gets passed over sober, and he gets thrown out, and he's got a family, and he's got a wife, and he's got a house, and he doesn't know he's going to pay any bills. You know, he doesn't have a job, he doesn't have a career now. This happened in sobriety, and he said he just whined and moped and cried and felt sorry for himself and talked about it and went to morning, noon, and night meetings. And, you know, people would say, does anybody want to share? Sandy wanted to share, you know. And he said, you know, everybody's eyes were glazing over, and, you know, he'd talk about this, and he went on for months and months, and he goes, but now when he talks, sometimes he'll say, and in my early years, I experienced a career change. So you can see where it sort of sounds different, you know, when you're hearing it now than it did for the old-timers who were living through it, you know, at the time. But anyway, when I came out of law school and I finished, it was time for me to take the bar exam. And, you know, that's another way, really, they just get you to pay some more money. But it's this big test, or, you know, whatever. So in order to take this test, you have to prepare for the test. And so I studied, you know, and I took all these classes, and I showed up, and I kept my AA commitments, and I tried to stay in touch with my higher power, and I tried to, you know, stay in, you know, touch with the people I sponsored, and I tried to do whatever I was supposed to do and do all my work to get ready for this big test. And then I took the big test, and I did the very best that I could, and I showed up, and then I went about my service commitments. But once you take the test, until you pass the test, you can't get a formal job as a lawyer. And this is like a 6-month period of time that they want to just see if you can, you know, wait and be miserable. So anyway, so you just try and wait one day at a time, you know, and be perky. So anyway, so I got this telegram in November of 1983 telling me that I did not pass the California bar exam. And I absolutely could not believe it. You know, it was, well, let's see, I was 11 years sober, 11 and a half years sober. And I had enough money to pay my rent on December 1st. This was like Thanksgiving weekend. December 1st was coming very quickly. And I had no other money. I didn't have a dollar to put in the basket at my home group. I didn't have any gas to put in my car at the meeting I was supposed to speak at that night. You know, I didn't have any food. I had no money. And I'm looking at this telegram. I mean, I must have read it, you know, 100 times. I could not believe it. And I will tell you that as I had to go speak at that meeting that night, there is no place I have ever wanted to go less that I can think of in the years that I have been sober. You know, that what am I going to stand up there and say? You know, and I looked at this telegram and I thought, this is ridiculous. I mean, I've just filled my head with all these stupid dreams. Obviously, I'm not going to be a lawyer. What, was I crazy? You know, I listen to those people in AA that, like, things can happen. I mean, I'm a waitress. You know, this is crazy. And I just got, you know, and I called my very best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told him, and he said, I'll meet you at the meeting. And I went to the meeting, and I stood up there, and I have no idea what I said. And then I went to coffee with my friend Mike after the meeting, and I showed him the telegram. And, you know, it was one of those conversations I had with Mike, which was very much like the conversations that many of you who are new, and some of you maybe right now, sometimes I still have them, with your sponsor. You know, like, where you're trying to explain things to your sponsor, and they're really not getting it. You know, like, maybe you had a situation like this, which I've had before. You call up your sponsor, and you go, hi, my rent is due tomorrow, and I don't have enough money. And they go, oh, go to a meeting and turn it over. You go, okay, maybe I said it too fast. My rent is due tomorrow. And by the way, my landlord is not in AA. And they'd like money, you know, about money. You know, because when they get sober a while, you think they forget about, like, those little things that, you know, the rest of us are interested in. And you try and explain, and they go, oh, go to a meeting, you know. And it's almost as if you stop someone on the street and you say, excuse me, what time is it? And they say, it's a horse. It's like, this is not helping. Do you understand? I mean, I'm calling my sponsor. It's not helping, you know. So I went out with Mike, and I showed him the telegram. And I said, you know what this means, don't you? He goes, what does that mean? I said, it means this was ridiculous. I mean, what was I doing spending 3 years in law school? I am a waitress. I'm supposed to be a waitress. It was crazy that I got this insane idea that because I'm sober in AA, I mean, I'm a seventh grade dropout. I am a waitress. That's what the telegram says. It's God laughing. He goes, well, let me see the telegram. Show him the telegram. He reads it. He goes, oh, no. He says, I think this says you're supposed to take it again. I go, no, that's not what it says. You know, we had a an hour and a half discussion on what the telegram really meant. And I go, look, Mike, you know, let me explain something to you. I have enough money to pay my rent, you know, in 3 days, and that's it. You know what I mean? I'm so broke I can't afford to pay attention here. You know, I said, I mean, you know, I'd have to borrow more money. I owe thousands of dollars. I don't have any money to pay these people back. He goes, well, borrow some more. You know, all right. You know, why not? So I did, and that's what I did, and I studied to take the exam again. You know, right around then I got a 12-step call from central office. And, you know, this lady, I picked her up. She was drunk and took her to a meeting. And by the time the meeting was over, she was kind of sobering up, and I took her back to my apartment, and we were sitting there, and it was just like a week or two later, and she's crying and crying, and she goes, oh, God, she says, you know, I don't know, I just don't know if I, you know, she says, I don't have enough money to pay my rent next month, and I go, neither do I. She goes, well, I mean, I don't have a job. I go, well, neither do I. And she's like, how long are you sober? It's like, 11 years. It's a really good program, though, really. I mean, keep coming back, you know. Anyway, I took the exam again. I got another telegram about 6 months later, and it said that I had passed and that I would be allowed to practice law. Now, I'd love to tell you that, you know, I had the same spiritual reaction to both telegrams, but that's just not true. You know, I mean, I was much happier, and I felt much closer to God and the 12 steps and the rest of it after the second telegram. You know, maybe in another life I'll get a little closer to that. Anyway, I am one of the people that meant the most to me in the early years of my sobriety was a guy named Norm Alpe, and I know a number of you have heard him. Every time I ever heard Norm Alpe speak, I wanted to join AA, and then I'd remember I already belonged or I wouldn't have been there hearing him speak, you know. But this guy had the most enthusiasm on a continuing basis of anyone that I knew, and he just inspired and touched my heart every time I heard him. And one of the things that Norm would say when he was done talking is he would say, you know, but for the grace of God, people like you in rooms like this, I could have missed it all. And, you know, there isn't a day that goes by, really, in my life. You know, today I'm a mom. I have three little kids. You know, I never wanted to have, you know, children. I was told at 15, after I was 2 years sober, that I needed to have a hysterectomy because of all the damage I'd done to my body, and I'd never have kids, you know. And now, you know, sometimes people come up to me and they go, oh, those kids look so much like you. I mean, those were fighting words before, you know, and now I can just say thank you. They are rather cute. They don't all have curly hair, but we can't have everything. You know, they'll have to get perms. You know, but I mean, you know, it's like I just can't even believe, you know, the life that I have. And it wouldn't have even been on my list. You know, I just can't tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous has, you know, has accomplished for me. And I have to tell you, you know, that even right now, today, I mean, I'm in, you know, I've got a couple dark hallways that I'm wandering through. And I suspect that there are some other people that I have some too, and some of them are longer than others, you know. All I know is that I've had some dark hallways in my time in sobriety, and I suspect I'll have more, you know. And all that I can hope for, you know, for me and for you, is that you'll keep coming back to meetings so that you can help me get through my hallways, and that I'll be able to continue to come to meetings so that perhaps I can share with you and help you get through your hallways, you know. And I just really hope that none of you give up before the miracle happens in your life. I have no idea what it's going to be, just as I've had no idea what mine were going to be or what they're going to be in the future. But I can only tell you that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with no dreams, no hopes, no desires, and you've given me a life filled with all of those things, and it's quite amazing, and I wish the same for you. Thank you.